Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Historical Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today we'll be talking with David Potter about his new book, Theodora, Actress, Empress, Saint. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
Delight to have you here. David, I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm professor of classics and ancient history at the University of Michigan, where I've been for the last 30 years. I have taught quite extensively across the range of Roman history, and a number of years ago began teaching courses on ancient public entertainment and ancient spectacle, which is actually how I got into the career of Theodora. So as a wonderful case where teaching has really helped me develop a research project here.
I think that focus, you know, comes across in this book, and as our listeners are going to discover in a little bit. Was this were you drawn to writing a biography, or were you approached about writing this book?
Well, I was asked by Oxford to write this book. I'd written a number of other books of more general sort on the history of the late Roman Empire, a biography of the Emperor Constantine. And it seemed a very interesting possibility to move later into the time of Theodora to look at the empire as it had developed over time, and also to look at a really very different kind of historical problem. And that's what I think drew me to the project most of all. With Constantine, we have somebody who frankly never shuts up. We have thousands of lines of Latin, you know, that Constantine must have approved, because their communications with his own senior officials, and we can sort of write about Constantine on the basis of Constantine. Whereas with Theodora, we have a very different sort of issue. We have Theodora as seen by others, and trying to sort of recover a personality, human being behind this, was just, to me, an intriguing problem, issue. I also love reading detective stories, and there is a certain sort of aspect of detection that goes into trying to find Theodora between the rabid hostility of one of our main sources, Procopius, and the incredibly pious celebration of her by John of Ephesus. And so how do we find this world and this society and fit her into it?
That is one of the things that stood out for me when I read your book, which was the amount of deductive reasoning that you put into these assessments of what do we take for granted, how do we use the source, what can we take from the source, which, while flawed, nonetheless can offer insights if used correctly.
That's exactly right. I mean, very often with somebody like Procopius, where there's smoke, there is fire. It may not be the same fire that he wants you to believe in, but there is usually something there. We can often get multiple versions of the same story from our different accounts. But also, an important thing is sort of getting an idea of what the possible is in this society. How could you accomplish something? How could you do something? And so, if we get a story that seems frankly impossible, we need to sort of sit back and think about what it could really mean. And, you know, frankly, the most astonishing aspect of this story is how a woman who had been the concubine of an imperial officer who had thrown her out of the house, moved off to Antioch, and somehow met the heir to the throne and became his wife. It's just, you know, what context do we have for this? It's a story like none other in the ancient world.
And that's one of the things that you do in this book, is you provide that context to help fill in a lot of the missing information about Theodora's life. And I was wondering if you could provide some of that context for us. Particularly, you start off by talking about Constantinople, and I was wondering if you could tell us what Constantinople was like in the late 5th, early 6th century.
Well, Constantinople was one of the really sort of vibrant centers of culture. It's a world where the Roman Empire, the traditions of the Roman Empire, were kept alive by the imperial government. It was, of course, a very heavily Christianized version of it. So we have intense dispute about the appropriate way to worship God. We have people coming together from all over the Mediterranean world. You sort of sense it in the food, and as you could do now if you go to Istanbul. I mean, you have influence coming in from the Balkans. Justinian was a peasant from the Balkans. We know that his uncle and adoptive father, Justin, is said to have packed up some local sausage and walked all the way to Istanbul to join the army. Theodora, interestingly, probably has a Balkan background. She's said to be a blonde. She is the daughter of a bear keeper, which, as we look at the jobs that people have in the imperial circus, a pretty respectable job. It's certainly worth bribing somebody to get, as happens with her when her biological father dies and her stepfather comes forward looking for the job. It's also a city that is a bit on edge. People are aware that they're not as powerful as they used to be. They could wander around the city and see the monuments of past emperors, but these aren't always bringing up really great memories. You can see the house of Basiliscus, but you can remember that this guy botched the invasion of North Africa 30 or 40 years ago. You can go to the monuments of various other emperors. You remember there's something a bit ambivalent about a bit of it. This is a city that needs its walls. It survived the world of Attila the Hun, but it isn't the sort of all-powerful Roman Empire of the distant past, and people know that. And then, of course, if you go down to the harbor, it's still may not be all-powerful, but it's still rich. It's where you'll meet people coming from Egypt or Africa or Spain or coming from the Persian Empire or coming out of central Syria, an extraordinary cosmopolitan society.
Mm-hmm. And it's also a community that is riven with political factionalism. And it's a politics that in some ways is very alien to us, and yet in some ways there's some, curious similarities. So I was wondering if you could speak to a bit about the factions and how that played into Theodora's family.
Yes. The crucial sort of organization of the common people in Constantinople is in terms of the circus factions. There are two primary ones, the Blues and the Greens, and the organized districts of the city. They bring people together. They sit them quite literally down in their tens of thousands in the hippodrome for the chariot races. When the emperors need to address the people as a whole, they tend to do so in the hippodrome at the chariot races to the people organized by their factions. Now, the factions include not only the physical organization of the chariot teams, where you have some quite powerful people who run them, are very highly compensated. The charioteers, some of these charioteers, again, extremely powerful and influential people. Just before Theodora's in her childhood, there was a man by the name of Porphyrius, a great charioteer, but also very powerful politically, a person who could have organized the people in one case to defend the city of Constantinople against attacks by a usurper. In another case, organize an appalling attack on the Jewish community in the city of Antioch. Very much of a sort of independent agent. And we have these people like Porphyrius and others who have a great deal of power that the government really has to negotiate with all the time.
So Their power is not in terms of high politics. It's more in terms of, and I hesitate to use the word mob rule, but sort of the popular politics of the street.
Yeah, it is very much the politics of the street. And the imperial government's got to be really careful because it can't control these politics all the time. Its authority is constantly negotiated with people. It can't think of doing something like shutting down the chariot races. There are occasions where the emperor is going to be at physical risk at the games. I mean, we have the great Nika revolt of 532 that Theodora and Justinian had to face, but it's just one in a series of popular uprisings in the circus.
So Theodora is exposed to politics at a very early age by virtue of her family's involvement with this. Which group was she aligned with?
Well, her first faction were the Greens. Her father was a barkeeper for the Greens, but then when he died, her mother tried to remarry and get the position for her new husband, but this was given to somebody else. And her mother brought Theodora and her two sisters into the floor of the circus and asked for support. It was an extraordinary, dramatic moment. And the Blues take them in to show them, everybody, that they're the truly generous people and that the Greens are cruel and corrupt and what have you.
So it's not in the way we might think of a gang today where, you know, if you're a Blue, you're a Blue for life, that there was oftentimes, people could cross from one group to another?
You could, but I think that the story of Theodora is a bit unusual. I mean, ordinarily people stayed pretty loyal to their faction. But you could move a bit. Charioteers, the major sort of entertainers, there's a certain sort of free agency that's available out there.
Interesting. You speak a bit about entertainment in Constantinople. Was it purely a matter of keeping the people happy, or was it more complicated than that?
Well, it was initially just a feature of government. I mean, centuries earlier, famously, the satirist Juvenal had said that the Roman people are controlled by bread and circuses. And then another observer said, yes, a good emperor is always aware of the need for entertainment and food to keep the people happy. And that was a major business of government. Part of the sort of ideology of government, of course, is its benefactions, that it reaches out and provides good things and secures good things for its people. And the good entertainment is certainly one way of doing it. It's also the mark of a sophisticated city. Not everybody can have a circus. It's a way of sort of showing the city off that it can manage these things. Just as also the government's responsible for making sure there's a supply of affordable grain for people.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I was not aware of before I read the book, but I was fascinated by it, was how you talked about you have the map in there that shows that the Hippodrome was actually attached to the palace.
Exactly. And if you go to Istanbul today, you can still see some remains of the walls of the Hippodrome, the massive things. But right now, the central sort of area of what would have been the center of the Hippodrome runs right in front of the Blue Mosque, which is built over the Imperial Palace. So you can still get an idea of the relationship between this central buildings of power in downtown Constantinople, Istanbul.
But, of course, what was going on in Constantinople wasn't, entirely about entertainment. There was also religion. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the religious environment in which Theodora lived.
Yes, well, the environment in which she lived was very much conditioned by the Council of Chalcedon in 451, which had established a particular doctrine about the nature of Christ, which asserted, again, his human divine nature. And very interestingly, a couple of years later, the sort of boogeyman of the mid-5th century, Attila the Hun, suddenly died. And I think that for some people, especially in the Balkans and around Constantinople, there was a connection. We finally got it right. We were worshiping God correctly, and he did in Attila, and we're safe now. But in other parts of the empire, there was a slightly different take on the relationship between the father and the son. And they were unwilling to see that there could be a separate human nature of Christ. And over time, these debates about Christ and the nature of Christ become incredibly intense. As an outsider, sometimes it's very difficult to sort of understand how deeply felt these issues can actually be. But it's like any kind of sort of community building or community activity, where sort of very small differences start defining who you are or different groups. And that's what's happened with Christianity. It's more than simply a question of doctrine. It becomes a question of who we are and what's our place in this world.
And it's also becomes a question of politics as well. And the two are so intertwined that all these seemingly abstract theological disputes have this very critical political dimension.
That's exactly right. It's hard for us, I think, to sort of have an immediate parallel to mine. But I think if you were to stand back 100 years from now and look at some of the debates that are going on in society now, I mean, for instance, the gun control debate, looking back on it, would you really say that people who are on a terrorist watch list should be allowed to, buy automatic weapons? But this has become an area of dogma and identity nowadays. And I think we have similar issues that you can see in Constantinople, where how could you possibly say that God died, which is what one position would be. The human nature of God has to be separate. But how can you say that? How can you say that there might be a difference between one God and the other? Trying to sort of see how things which might seem on the outside difficult can become emotionally incredibly important is something I've been trying to do in this book, is to try to help people understand that the religious disputes of this period are really deeply emotional community issues.
And they were ones that leaders had to walk a very fine line on in many ways. Where did Theodora reside in this divide?
Well, Theodora had a very interesting religious career. She was very much a supporter of the anti-Chalcedonian faction, which was extremely powerful in Egypt, where, again, the modern Coptic Church is a descendant of an anti-Chalcedonian movement. Also in Syria, in the area, of course, around Antioch and east of that. She had a very close personal connection with a very powerful bishop by the name of Severus, Severus of Antioch. And my suspicion is that when she was really at her most sort of desperate, she found in the church in Antioch a community that would take her in after she'd been thrown out by her former lover and the father of her child. One of the key messages of Severus, of course, was redemption was possible for everyone and for anyone. I doubt that she and Severus had much in common. She'd been a mime actress. She'd been a very successful mime actress. Sort of thing that Severus disapproved of very strongly. But there's a sort of tie-in between the church and the stage. And, the church, if they can get an actress to stop being an actress, this is a big deal. It's a sign of moral change in a good way. So I think that the anti-Chalcedonian movement and its message of redemption was something that Theodora made very much her own as she's trying to put her life back together.
We've been talking a lot about the context. Let's talk a bit about Theodora herself, although it will be drawing upon that context a bit more. Her life as an actress, it seems that she had this, on the one hand, she's in an occupation that was not necessarily highly regarded morally. And yet, at the same time, it was a position that had a certain amount of stature and opened up enormous opportunities, as it obviously did for Theodora.
Right. Well, one of the curiosities throughout Roman history is that the official line on public entertainers is that these are people who are amoral They are people who are eliminated from polite society, should not be allowed to participate in polite society, etc. Whereas at the same time, these are people who could make a great deal of money. One of the richest people we hear of any point in antiquity is a charioteer in the second century by the name of Diocles, who made over 20 million sesterces in the course of his career, much wealthier than members of the Senate. We have law codes, or issues in the law codes about actresses, for instance, that they're dressing like the empress, and the emperor saying, stop doing that, please, because they're so very wealthy. We can trace the careers of actors in papyri and in documents to see how much money they made. There's a really important work by a Finnish scholar named Manna Vastrinen, who traced the direct evidence for the money made by actors and actresses and looked at their sort of career formation through the documentary record, directly relevant really to Theodora. So we can see that this is really a good middle class, upper middle class sort of occupation. And of course, if you make it to the top, if you're a star, you're a public figure just as you are nowadays, and everybody's wanting to see, you know, how do you dress, where you're going. These are people also who are very famous for the openness, freedom of their lifestyle. The official line, of course, is that women should marry and have children, and that's that. But the independent women of the stage are very much the opposite. They take the lovers they choose. They live independently. Theodora, now, in her late teens, seems to have had her own place to live, had a wide range of admirers. That would be typical of an actress in her generation.
And there was, though, sometimes a transition between being an actress and being a prostitute or a mistress. And what exactly, you know, how did that relationship work out?
Well, very often, what we can see, of course, is that the careers of successful actresses are limited. Most people's careers sort of run from their late teens into their early 20s, as Theodora's did. It seems that what Theodora was really looking for, you know, when she got into her early 20s, was a good deal more stability in her life. And she met a man by the name of Hecabolus, who's a well-placed imperial official going to go off and be an imperial governor. She's probably a great catch for him. She's a, you know, famous actress. Everybody who writes about her says she was absolutely gorgeous. And so he's has his new girlfriend, his beautiful, bright, charming Theodora, and the understanding will be that he won't have other mistresses, other sexual relations, while she's living with him, and that he's supposed to support her. But you know, it's still a very tenuous lifestyle, but it's the best that a former actress could hope for, at least until she met Justinian.
Well, what would she be trying to avoid? I mean, what's sort of what's the worst case scenario that she never fell into?
What the worst case scenario that she would fall into, I think, would be prostitution. That she would really lose control over her own choice of partners and would be having to have sex for money to stay alive. She seems to be very conscious of that being a possible avenue. She is extremely supportive of programs when she's empress to try to protect prostitutes from the worst aspects of their lives. She tries to get them out of prostitution, to give them new occupations, to give them the money that they need. They're, you know, to try to prevent people entering prostitution. Her later policy suggests that she saw that as a possible end for herself, as a way of making a living for herself, and supporting her child, and she was desperately keen to avoid it.
There did seem to be sort of a "there but for the grace of God go I," you know.
I think there was very much that in Theodora. When Hecabolus threw her out, as you know, we're told that he did, she had to really find a way to make it on her own. I think she still had some money. She'd been a successful actress. She had a lot of ability, a lot of talent, so she was able to get herself a job working for the Imperial Intelligence Service, spying in Antioch on people and connected with the circus factions. But she was really faced with making a major career change and finding a way that she wouldn't fall into prostitution.
So how does she avoid going down that route?
Well, she must have had connections still within the faction of the Blue. And when she got to Antioch, it looks like she used those connections to get a job. And the people who ran the factions were connected with the imperial government, especially the Blues, who were favored by Justinian, who was sort of emerging at this point as a significant figure, as the adoptive son of the Emperor Justin. We get an idea of the kinds of issues that would come up that the government is very worried about. We actually have the report of another spy in Antioch who was sent out to a town in Syria to see whether or not they weren't actually worshiping a heretic. And he writes back and sort of points out the lies the local authorities are telling you. I mean, the imperial government knows that its officials lie to it all the time. And so they need people sort of outside of the official reporting lines to tell them what's really going on. And Theodora became one of these people.
How does she meet Justinian? Do we have any details about that?
We don't know how she meets him. It seems to be that there's one story that comes down through Procopius, which he mangles, as he does everything in her life, but it seems to be sort of part of her official biography, that she went off to Constantinople and that she met Justinian there. I would think in a way that since he was very keen on the Blue faction, something may have come in where he looked at something and said, "Boy, this one's good," or "Who is the person who wrote this? I'd like to meet her." And Justinian was a man of extraordinary, abstemious lifestyle. I mean, he sort of lived like a monk when he wasn't living with Theodora. And so I think that he wouldn't have known really, perhaps, he may have known who she was from Antioch, or from her background in Istanbul before then. But I think it was really something that happened, something she did in Antioch that attracted her, his attention to her. And then he just fell head over heels in love with her within about a year of the first time they met. Can't have been more than that. He has gone to his father, the emperor, and said, "I want a law that enables me to marry an actress." And he obtains the status of patrician for her. And this is not a political move on his point. So the worst thing he could possibly do if he wants to be the next emperor, he's taken up with a woman who really is openly anti-Chalcedonian. She's a former actress. She has a child by a former partner. And Justinian takes all of it in.
Really does come across as a real statement of love for her that he does all these things.
It really is. I think it's an extraordinary. I mean, this is one of the great love stories.
I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about Justinian himself. I mean, who was he, and how does he become emperor?
Well, Justinian started life living in the Balkans. His uncle, Justin, joined the army and was extremely successful. He really rose in the ranks from private to head of the Imperial Guard. When the Emperor Anastasius died, Justin was in a position to have himself made emperor. And so when he's made emperor, he has brought his nephew along, and Justinian played some role in helping stage manage Justin's accession, getting people in the right place so things would work out correctly. And so he becomes an important aide to Justin from the very beginning of his reign. But, you know, he's not clearly in the line of succession, even though Justin has adopted him. No son has succeeded his father on the throne in a century before the accession of Justinian in 527. So it's a very careful political process that he has to steer here between 518 and 527 in that decade to get himself into a position to be the heir.
And roughly when does he meet Theodora?
He meets Theodora, I think, probably in 520-521. The law that is passed allowing them to be married, and it's incredibly person-specific. It's clear it can be only about Theodora, because you envisage former actress who wants to marry a member of the upper class who has her own daughter and what have you. The latest that law could have been issued is in the summer of 522, because we know the career of the official who actually wrote it, a man by the name of Demosthenes. So they must have met sometime in the previous year, previous 18 months, so 520, 521, they would have met.
And how old was Theodora around this point?
At that point, she is probably born. Again, we don't really know the year of her birth, but all of the evidence about her career would suggest she was born in 497, and so she'll be in her mid-20s at that point. This is a point, if she'd been a woman of upper-class status, she might have been married for nearly a decade, but as a woman of her time, it's a relatively late marriage for her, and Justinian's a decade older than she is. And one of the things that's strange or interesting about him is there are no illegitimate children, there are no other mistresses, there's no other significant connection. Part of this may have been that members of the aristocracy were unwilling to make a political alliance with Justin or to have their daughters marry his adoptive son. But part of it may also have been personal choice on Justinian's part. We know that he was very keen on theology. He lived a very ascetic lifestyle, sort of a monk in the palace, as it were, until he met Theodora.
And also the fact that Justinian was not guaranteed to succeed Justin as emperor.
Exactly. And that, as I was saying, is part of this risk factor here. I'm going to move this young woman into the palace, and she isn't going to be approved of, certainly by the patriarch, because we all seem to know that she's got connections with Severus of Antioch and all these other anti-Chalcedonians. In fact, one of her values to Justinian is that she can actually be a bridge to the anti-Chalcedonian community, because Justin, a very strong Chalcedonian emperor, is clearly loathed by the anti-Chalcedonian group who he'd persecuted early in his reign. But as problems develop in the 520s, especially down in southern Arabia, as there's a sudden upsurge of violence in the area in an effort to build an Arabian coalition against the Roman Empire, is partially diffused through the non-Chalcedonian connections of Justinian and Theodora.
Hmm. So how does Justinian become emperor? How does he basically ensure the succession of his father when his father dies?
I think it really has to begin with the successful negotiation of the crisis in Arabia, where a leader had emerged, a very staunchly Jewish leader named Dhul Nawas in southern Arabia, went and massacred the Christian population at a place called Najran. It was a complex situation where a Christian administration had been brought into the area from Ethiopia, actually. But in the winter months, Dhul Nawas had taken advantage of the inability of the Ethiopian army to recross the sea, massacred the Christian community, and then gone up to the sort of Arab confederations on the border of the Roman Empire and tried to urge them to join him in a war against all Christians. And it was at a complicated meeting that was organized by people that we know to be connected with Theodora, that this situation was diffused. And after that, we can see that Justinian seems to be on the fast track to becoming emperor.
So Justinian becomes emperor in 527,
yeah.
And Theodora then becomes the empress. What did being empress entail, and what were her responsibilities? What was her life like as empress?
Well, officially, the empress sort of models ideal feminine behavior. She is supposed to engage in sort of polite charities, charity work. She will play a role in negotiating marriages amongst members of the upper class. She is not supposed to be engaged in the sort of big business of government, but you know, that is something that has been sort of brought into question already by Ariadne, who was the wife of two previous emperors, Zeno and Anastasius, and said that she thought Zeno was so repulsive that she had him buried alive. She was the daughter of the emperor Leo, a very, very powerful figure. And so this notion that the empress could be more than somebody who did polite good works was certainly established very firmly by Ariadne. And under Theodora, again, she's a powerful figure. She meets with the imperial council. Not even Ariadne had done that. She seems to get on extremely well with a number of Justinian's most important officials, including Trebonian, who's the great lawyer of the reign, who produced the Corpus of Civil Law, one of the great contributions of the era of Justinian to European history generally. She got on with a number of other, we can see, senior officials and members of the imperial, of the army. One of her important connections, at least in a positive way early on, is with the general Belisarius. They're later going to have a terrible falling out, but at this stage, she's very close to him and to his wife, who's also a former actress. Belisarius is another person who's a peasant background from the Balkans. This is a point where Justinian is really pulling together people with a lot of non-traditional backgrounds to be at the center of government, and Theodora is at the center of that group. There are going to be a few people she can't stand as well. I mean, the chief financial official, John of Cappadocia, and she have a very rocky relationship throughout the reign until she finally gets him exiled to Egypt. But she'll also play a role with the church. Again, the traditional role of the empress is, again, to be sort of modeling the Virgin Mary on earth. And you can imagine there's some sort of conservative people. What is this for?
Yes.
With an illegitimate child modeling the Virgin Mary?
That was one of the things that it really struck me. It was how she did seem to have a much larger religious role. I can't remember exactly how you put it in the book, but how she, in a sense, had certain responsibilities, you know, within, you know, in the context of the imperial couple that were predominantly or almost exclusively hers.
That's,
when it came to religion.
That's exactly right. Well, she has churches that she is the patron of. There are various orders and groups that come to her first and foremost. She has enormous wealth of her own, and she's able to distribute money on her own. She doesn't have to sort of ask Justinian what to do with it. And so she plays a role giving great gifts to churches. When Antioch is hit by an earthquake, she and Justinian, each acting in their own name, help rebuild the city. And this is, I think, a sort of role of the independent empress that had actually, you know, come to the fore in the previous century, not only with Ariadne, but there was Ariadne's mother, Verena. There was Pulcheria, the sister of the Emperor Theodosius II, and empress in her own right when her brother died, and she picked the next emperor, Marcian, and married him on the provision that they never had sex. So,
and yet she didn't just function in her own role. She was really a very influential advisor to Justinian in some key instances. And I think the one that really stands out in the book is regarding the Nika revolt. I was wondering if you could speak a bit about that revolt and just how pivotal Theodora was in Justinian's out in the outcome for Justinian.
Yes, the Nika revolt was in January of 532. It was a time when Justinian was already having some difficulties. He'd gone to war with the Persians a couple of years before, and the war had not been going especially well. Belisarius, his general, had won one battle, but he'd lost the second battle. There are peace negotiations going on. The Persians have been treating the Roman Empire sort of like a bank. They always seem to be so short on cash. And when they did so, they would raid the Roman Empire, make a treaty with the Romans, and the Romans would pick up their expenses in some place. And these negotiations are going on. It doesn't look good. I mean, your first big foreign policy initiative is a failure. And then there's a riot in the Hippodrome right at the beginning of January, and some people are arrested. And the prefect of the city says, we're going to go execute these people. And when that happens, the rope breaks. And a number of people who've been sentenced to death are rescued by the mob. Now, at this point, Justinian botches pretty much everything he does. And he's clearly not listening to people with any kind of good sense. Probably just the prefect of the city said, I don't like this. We're going to get these people. We're going to execute them. I don't care what the mob thinks. But then at the circus, the crowd starts demanding the release of these prisoners, and Justinian won't do it. And then the crowd goes out and it sets fire in the heart of the city. Major buildings are burnt down. They want to, they want the prefect of the city out of office. They want a whole series of other, the demands keep escalating. And Justinian doesn't react at all rapidly, and he makes the crisis worse by reacting very slowly. And finally, some members of the family of Anastasius think that there's going to be an opportunity here to seize the throne, to drive Justinian out, and they begin plotting against him. And it looks like Justinian is going to flee the city in the midst of the riot, and Theodora then walks into the imperial council and gives a speech. And it's unfortunately, we don't know what she actually said. It's just reported to us by Procopius. But certainly the version that everybody got was Justinian was ready to throw in the towel, and Theodora came in and said, no way. She's given a wonderful line in her speech. The purple is a wonderful burial shroud, that she will never see a day where she is not called mistress. And it's up to Justinian to pull himself together and put down this revolt, which he does, and extremely violently after that. He sends in the imperial guard to massacre a crowd which is gathered in the Hippodrome. The numbers killed, we are given all kinds of numbers, very large numbers, 35,000, 50,000, etc. We don't really know how many people died on this occasion. It brought the riot to an end. But it's a sign here that Theodora was very willing to support extremely strong action to protect her position. She was going to stay on the throne, and she is certainly responsible, much as anybody, for the massacre in the Hippodrome that ended the Nika revolt, and also kept Justinian on the throne. And she is said to have insisted on the execution of the members of Anastasius's family, who had been one of them, Hypatius, who'd been trying to make himself emperor.
She seemed to have a real hunger for her position that Justinian doesn't seem to evidence as much.
Yes. Well, she seems a lot better at practical action than Justinian does. Justinian will theorize anything to death, whereas Theodora will actually come out and say, no, this is what we're actually going to do this. And we can feel her at the time of the Nika revolt. just as we can see her in years leading up to this, for instance, trying to end child prostitution in Constantinople. She is certainly recognized around the empire as a very, very powerful, effective figure. And one thing that's also very striking is that when she dies in 548, the administration of Justinian really seems to lose its way. You know, that there's the sense that she is really the person who, if you need to get things done, actually did them.
So to what degree was she involved in some of the major decisions that were resolved during Justinian's reign, such as the war in Africa, the Gothic War? Do we have any evidence that she participated in those well, or were there other councils that were more significant?
There were a lot of people who probably played a major role in one of the great successes of the reign of Justinian, and that was the invasion of North Africa, which had been occupied since the late 430s by the Vandals, who had really established an extremely successful, highly piratical state in North Africa. And they're very wealthy as well. They had in their possession the treasures of the imperial palace, which they'd sacked back in 453. 455, sorry. They were an easy target. There was also a lot of evidence for political unrest in the kingdom in the 530s. And after January 532, I think Justinian was desperate. He needed to do something. He needed a smashing success. There was some reason to believe that they could be successful in North Africa, and it would reverse a notable failure of earlier years. What makes me think that Theodora played a somewhat significant role in this planning was actually the choice of Belisarius to be the general. She was close to his wife. Belisarius, who, of course, later becomes the great military figure of the reign of Justinian, didn't have a great record up to that point. He hadn't done particularly well against the Persians. So how did he get command of this great expedition in North Africa? And I suspect it was his connections in the palace that did that, so that would have been Theodora. The Gothic War, when that comes about after the reconquest of North Africa, again, we can see Theodora is part of a series of negotiations with the Gothic regime. She has her own agents in the West. Now, she's not supposed to be running a war on her own. I don't think she did that, but I think that in terms of high-level policymaking, she did play a major role.
And yet she dies in her mid-50s. What were the circumstances behind her death? Was it how were her final years, and how is her relationship with Justinian in her later years?
Well, she died of cancer, in 548. She and Justinian remained incredibly close despite some very obvious public disagreements. One of them was over the role of the anti-Chalcedonian clergy. At one point, Theodora had supported and succeeded in getting anti-Chalcedonian bishops appointed in Constantinople and Alexandria. That turned out to be a complete failure, partially because of the people that she'd chosen, and partially because it got tied up with the politics of the Gothic War, and the Bishop of Rome just wasn't going to deal with the regime of Justinian if he didn't have pro-Chalcedonian bishops in place. They disagreed certainly over the role of John of Cappadocia, the chief financial official of the previous decade, with whom Theodora had a major falling out. And Theodora managed to get him exiled. Again, we can see that she's the driving force behind John's exile, and that Justinian keeps trying not to do it. she tries to warn him off, be careful, don't do this, don't go to that meeting. But Theodora manages to arrange for his exile out to a part of Egypt that she controls. There are these moments of conflict, but the thing that comes through again and again and again is just how devoted Justinian is to her and how devoted I think she is to him. They can disagree, but they keep going on. And I think one of the most meaningful moments after her death, this is a time when Justinian has been out of the city, and he comes back in, and he stops the procession at her tomb so he can get off and pray for her. So here it is, years after her death, that Justinian is still advertising his great love for her.
So how is it that after her death, and in spite of the, you know, very real devotion that Justinian has for her, does she develop such a negative reputation? You mentioned Procopius, you know, never seems to have a good word for her. And she comes across it with the, you know, from Procopius and some of the other writings, with an image that, as you describe at the end of the book, you know, she only within the past, you know, within recent times has finally started to shake.
Yes. Well, I think the problem here is Procopius' Secret History, which is one of the nastier pieces of work ever written. I think he wrote it as a sort of to keep secret, right after a plot to unseat Justinian had been uncovered in the early 550s. And it's this sort of recantation. He'd been a propagandist for the regime, writing the history of the wars and history of the buildings for years. And I think he really wanted to prove to the next emperor, if it should emerge out of these conspiracies, that he really wasn't the sort of complete loyalist that he'd been making himself out to be. You know, the picture of Theodora at the Nika revolt is actually in the history of the wars, and it's clearly intended to be a positive picture of her from Procopius. But he undermines it all with this sort of large-scale sexual fantasy that he uncorks in the Secret History. But you know, when we think about the Middle Ages and the history of this period, people knew very little about this period as we come into the Renaissance. They just had Procopius's History of the Wars. They had the Code of Justinian. But Theodora is sort of in the background, except for, you know, the moment where she gets rid of John the Cappadocian and the Nika revolt in all of this. Or in Catholic historians, people hate her because they see her as responsible for the exile and execution of a pope. Again, she's remembered in the Western tradition as a staunch anti-Chalcedonian, somebody who the true believers really don't like. So that negative tradition. And then when the Secret History is discovered, this becomes, you know, the delight of everybody, especially, of course, Gibbon, who quotes bits and pieces of it with delight in the time of all the Roman Empire, as a way of sort of shaping, and Montesquieu had done this before Gibbon, a way of sort of shaping an image of the Byzantine world as somehow inferior to the Roman Empire. It's, you know, the world is going downhill, and the symbol of it is this actress and prostitute should become Empress of Rome. Can't get much worse than that, especially not in the views of 17th century intellectuals, 18th century intellectuals. But then, in the last century, we've recovered the writings of the Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox community, that is Eastern Orthodox, the Syrian Orthodox Church in particular, and the writings of John of Ephesus and others, many of whom quoted John. We've paid more attention to the writings of chroniclers who tell us a lot about Theodora, but they don't have the political angle that Procopius did. You know, frankly, there were a lot of writers of history in the 19th century who seemed to be drawn to the smut of Procopius over the facts of other people. But it fit with an overall picture of the Byzantine Empire as somehow sort of somewhat decadent, somewhat corrupt, not this incredibly vibrant society that it really was.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Well, I've changed gears a bit now, and I'm doing a book for a new series to be published by Profile Press in England and Harvard in the United States. It's a history of the rise of the Roman Empire, and I'd like to think that it can balance the history of the Byzantine Age.
Wow. Sounds like quite a fascinating project. Is it a large work, or is it more of a short introduction?
It should be. It's a relatively large work. It should be about 150,000 words, according to my publisher, when it gets done. And hopefully it'll give people an enjoyable and readable image of how the Roman Empire came together.
I look forward to reading it. Well, David, I want to thank you for being on our show today. Really enjoyed talking with you about Theodora and her very interesting life and times. Take care and have a good day.
Thank you very much for having me.